Children's Church. You guys are dismissed as well. This morning, we are going to wrap up our series called Strange Election Things. And part of the struggle with, first of all, I hope that this series has been helpful for you to maybe recalibrate your perspective or give you a sense of hope. And if that doesn't happen by now, I hope it will happen before we are done here this morning, because hope is one of the themes that we're going to kind of unpack this morning. But one of the struggles with doing a series like this, and one of you had mentioned to me either last week or the week before that you were really appreciating things that we were talking about, and I said, you know, this hasn't been easy because there is a fine line that I feel like I can walk about things that need to be said and things that I want to say, but at the same time, not overtly pointing to one thing or another, but allowing God to have some space in your heart that you would vote your conscience, that you would say things that need to be said, but always done in a manner of love. So I hope that's what has happened. But one of the struggles that comes up whenever we have these kind of conversations, and I'm not just talking about in church, but even when you're talking with somebody at the water cooler or in your family, we all have filters, right? You have a filter about things that you hear. We'll just keep it to the political spectrum. When someone says something, your filter goes into action, and you start to wonder, okay, I hear what they're saying, but what are they really saying, right? Anybody else willing to admit that you have a filter, that anytime somebody opens their mouth and they start talking about things, you kind of go, all right, yeah, get to the point. You really want to talk about this. You don't want to talk about this thing over here. This was like an entrance piece for us to talk, but you really want to get to over here. So here's what I want to ask you to do. I want you to put your filters away for the next few minutes that I'm going to talk. Because here's the reason why. What I'm going to say is exactly what I mean. Okay? I'm not backloading anything. I am not going to drop the bomb at the end. What I say is exactly what I mean. Okay? So as we talk about these things, you may get to a point and you're going to go, oh, that's what he's really talking about. No, don't do that. Okay? Just hear what I'm saying and take it for what it's worth. That's not an easy thing to do in our culture because we are just certain that everyone has an agenda and everyone is saying something else other than what's coming out of their mouth. So put all of your political party filters away, all of your personal right filters away, all of your I'm right and you're wrong filters away. Just put all of that down and just understand that what I'm going to say is precisely what I mean. There's no hidden agenda here. One of the statements that we have had throughout this series, go to that first slide there, is this. I've been kind of encouraging us as a church to adopt this, that I am putting my faith first and my politics second. That if you are a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian or however else you define yourself in the political world, that would be a secondary thing to your faith and your relationship with Jesus Christ. So, having come through the election, moving towards Thanksgiving, what do we as a nation have to be thankful for? What is it that we can point to and say, well, I am thankful for that deal, that thing about our nation? Go to the next slide. Here's one of the things that we can be thankful for, the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is a somewhat unique thing that guarantees personal, individual freedoms in our country. There are some countries that have adopted little pieces of this Bill of Rights, this idea, but we are very unique in the world. Many countries that you and I would go to, the individuals, the people, the citizens of that nation do not have the kind of individual rights that you and I do in this country. Now, but for us, the Bill of Rights, we kind of take it for granted, don't we? Let's just expose that for a second. Anybody able to name all 10 Bill of Rights? Now, we know a couple of them. A couple of them are real hot button issues for us. Here, I'll just give you a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the Bill of Rights. The first one is the freedom of religion. That is that this gathering is not governed by law. It is not something that is prohibited or limited by law. And the other part of this that maybe we don't think about as Christians and that we maybe should be more aware of is this, that obviously, in our country, the kind of religion isn't limited either. So there's a freedom to practice, but there's also this freedom to experience any kind of religion that you want, even anything that you want to kind of make up and call religion. There is freedom in this country to participate and exercise that. I don't know if you're aware of this. The second Bill of Rights says that in peacetime, you and I do not have to quarter soldiers. I did not know that was in the second Amendment on the Bill of Rights. During peacetime, you do not have to allow a soldier to come in and live at your place in peacetime. It's part of one of the guaranteed rights of the Bill of Rights. The third one, this is one that we're probably very much aware of, the right to bear arms, correct? Now, don't go, that's not what I'm driving at. I'm not going to talk about gun rights today, okay? Put your filters away. So that is the third in the Bill of Rights. You go to the fourth one. We are free from unlawful or non-probable search and seizure of our property. The authorities cannot come to your house and say, hey, we want to search your place. And if they don't have probable cause, you can tell them to go away. And they have to go away. Numbers 5, 6, and 7 all deal with your rights as someone who is being tried in a court. Has to do with a speedy trial and due process and all of those kind of things. If you jump down to number 8, we are free from cruel and unusual punishment. Now, number 9 is perhaps the most important of all of the amendments. Go ahead and put that slide up there. Number 9, and we don't talk like this anymore, and maybe we should. There's some really cool language that is from the post-revolutionary time. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In 21st century language, and again, we don't talk like that, so we can look at that and kind of go, oh, I think I know what that means, but I'm not really sure. 21st century language is this. I have the right to do what I want, when I want, with whomever I want, as long as what I want doesn't infringe on someone else's rights. That's what the Ninth Amendment means. See, the Founding Fathers were really brilliant in putting this amendment in the Bill of Rights because they knew, you know what, time changes. And we don't know everything. We can't see into the future. We don't know everything that's going to change and how the world is going to change, how this country is going to change. And so what they did, this is kind of like a catch-all that says, as Americans, we have the right to do a vast variety of things as long as our rights don't infringe on the rights of other people. The Ninth Amendment is the best one. You've probably heard and maybe even said, I have the right. That's a Ninth Amendment statement. I have the right to do this. I have the right to go here. I have the right to take this job. I have the right to marry this person. That is a right that is guaranteed through the Bill of Rights. Now, there is a problem that begins to surface because rights are connected to responsibilities. When we disconnect or decouple our rights and our responsibilities, there are problems that arise. Now, if you're a parent, you have been a parent, or you currently have kids at home, you recognize this because as your kids get older, they have certain rights that are given to them by the government, but you as a parent say, you might have the right, but you didn't engage in the responsibility. Now, let's just do a quick little poll here. How many of you, when you were teenage drivers, had the keys taken from you? Anybody? Okay, good. Yeah, put that hand up. It's probably a really funny story connected to that. I mean, be proud. I had my responsibilities revoked and my rights taken away. How many of you had, and this never happened in my house, but I remember seeing this at friend's house. I went to their house and the door to the sister's bedroom was missing. Anybody have their door off of their bedroom taken away? Nobody? Well, that's a little surprising. That wasn't a comment on that I know some of you, but that does fit. Okay, that's even more surprising now that I kind of connect some dots. Yeah, that's an interesting one, right? So maybe the conversation was, hey, if you're going to go up there and slam your door, we're just going to take the door away. So there are rights that are guaranteed to us nationwide, but if we do not engage in the responsible use of those rights, they can be taken from us. But that is something that our nation has kind of separated from, rights and responsibilities. An important point, and this is one of the things that we will talk about consistently throughout this morning, is that liberty can consume liberty. Freedom can devour freedom. If there is a Bill of Rights, why isn't there a Bill of Responsibility? You ever think about that? I had never kind of put those two things together, but it makes a lot of sense to ask that kind of question. If there is a Bill of Rights, these are the things that I am allowed to do. I have a lot of freedom in the Bill of Rights, but there is no Bill of Responsibility. You can look through all kinds of government documents from the beginning, the advent of our country, and there is no Bill of Responsibility. Why is that? Here's part of the reason, and this tracks back to the conversation we had several weeks ago about our national conscience. When the framers of the Constitution began to put together what it means to be America and be citizens of America, there was a national conscience. There were assumed moral guardrails. Now, if you go back and look at a lot of the things that the framers of the Constitution, those leaders, both men and women, the things that they would write in war letters, the things that they wrote as a part of our national documents, you will see an assumed conscience that there were moral guardrails that kind of guide everything that they did and everything that they thought. They felt a great responsibility to the country as a whole. They felt a great responsibility and connection to their home communities. That was part of the responsibility that they had within their system. They had just recently come out of the Revolutionary War, so there was, I've heard it described like this, that there was a little bit of a foxhole mentality, that you cared for the people that were next to you because the people that were next to you, that might be all you have. So there was this relationship and connection and responsibility to and for one another. Also, you'll understand too, as you read some of those old documents, that there was a high value for God. Now, I said this a few weeks ago, I don't want to overly romanticize the post-revolutionary wartime of our country. I don't want to set up those men who created and signed the Declaration of Independence and put the Bill of Rights together and assume that they were all good Christian men, because quite honestly, they weren't. There were some of them that were kind of, they were scoundrels. They were not good men. Some of them owned slaves. Some of them were philanderers. They were not good men. But there were a handful, there was this understanding among all of them that there was a gratitude and a gratefulness and a responsibility to God. There are three assumptions that you can find throughout early American writings, particularly related to our government. Go ahead. Yeah, this here, the early American assumptions was there was a consensus on conscience. That was that there was an idea among the whole of the country, this is what's right and this is what's wrong, and it was something that was guided by God. There was also a consensus of divine accountability, that as we experienced this new freedom and victory and secession from England, that it was not just because of how great we are and our military might and our ingenuity. We are here because God made it happen. That was part of an understanding among the people. And because God made it happen, I am grateful to God for it. And then also individual expression. This is another part of the assumptions. Individual expression was governed by a concern for another. The individual expression of my freedoms, there was this recognition that what I do and what I say has impact on more than just me. It's not about me. It's about how the way I express and the way that I live my life has impact on someone else. There was this connection to other people, that I am not autonomous. I do not stand on my own. I am connected to others around me. Now, even in the Declaration of Independence, the preamble, those first lines of the Declaration of Independence read like this: we hold these truths to be self-evident. Self-evident, that means that there's an understanding. We're going to say this, we're going to write this down, but everyone understands. Everyone believes and thinks in the same fashion. There is a connection, just reading what it says, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain rights. So that we stand here and I have rights, but I didn't make up my own rights. I don't deserve these just on my own merit. There's an understanding that the rights that I have, they're given by God. That is a significant departure from where we are now as a country, isn't it? Because my rights are, well, they're about me. My rights are for me, and you may not even make it into the picture. That they were accountable to God for how they exercised their rights. John Adams is one of the great framers of the Constitution, an important figure in our own history, and he said this: our Constitution was written for moral and religious people. There's this understanding that if, in fact, there's another part of this quote that I didn't include here, but he says, this Constitution is wholly inadequate to every other government. And the reason that he says this is simple, that we understand that there is an accountability to God. And our rights are not just for us. And if we begin to think about our rights as solely and wholly for us, then liberty will devour liberty. Freedom will gobble up freedom. We've mentioned in the past here, past couple of weeks, that the amount of laws that are on our books in our nation are unnumbered. There is no number for them. Not because there's not a number big enough, but because we just stopped counting. There's just so many laws. Every year there are more laws added and more laws added. And the reason for that is we are always looking for loopholes. We are always looking for a way out, some way to short sheet the thing or experience something different or a way for me to do what I want to do. And when people are constantly looking for loopholes, constantly saying, I want to express my freedom for me, their only accountability is not to God anymore, it is to government and the written law. The law says this is what it means to be a citizen. The law says this is the lowest rung. This is who decides what's right and wrong. Now, if we were to take that mindset back into the post-revolutionary war days of our country, they would have said, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Your rights impact other people and how you live. And you're talking about rights being just for you? That's ridiculous. That will never work. The problem with the law is that it represents the minimum requirement. How low can I go? So just think about this in terms of your driving, my driving. One of the things that we are always kind of in process thinking about, and maybe we don't get this far down the road, but we're always thinking about how fast, the speed limit is here, how fast can I go before they pull me over, right? And how fast can I go if they pull me over but before they give me a ticket? There's like a couple miles an hour in there that I can get pulled over but they won't give me a ticket. And then how fast can I go that they'll pull me over and give me a ticket but not take me to jail? And then how fast can I go before they take me to jail, but before they take my license and my right to drive entirely? Because that is what the law does. It says, here's the bare minimum. Here is the bottom rung. What can I get away with? The law is powerless to do the most important thing. It's absolutely powerless to inspire greatness. The law is powerless to inspire courage and virtue. The law is powerless to change your heart and change mine. Traffic laws are good, but they don't create courteous drivers, right? Tax laws are good, but they don't make you generous. Heck, they don't even always make us pay our own taxes, right? Free speech does not make you kind, and marriage laws do not make you a good spouse. Just because something is on the books does not mean that is how we will operate above that. Individual rights that are regulated by law result in this, a collection of very selfish and narcissistic individuals who think dominantly of themselves. And rights become nothing more than an exercise in power. And when this is our standard, the rich will always rule the poor, women will always be objectified, and children will always be victimized. When we look at our rights as serving us. So as a nation, and I may have mentioned this last week, and I hope this isn't true, but I have a suspicion, a sneaking understanding that this is where we are. As a nation, we have permanently decoupled ourselves from, our legal system is permanently decoupled from divine authority and moral absolutes. That there is not going to be, there won't be a return. And again, I hope I'm wrong about this, but I don't think there is any returning, any going back to where we once were as a nation, where divine authority and moral absolutes were held up here at a high standard. But there is hope in you and I as the church. There was a really, really wonderful article that I shared on social media last week, and some of you read it and shared it, and it was so good because it talked about what the church's responsibility is now in the wake of the election. What is the church's responsibility? How are we supposed to engage in a society that has decided to distance itself from moral authority? Well, here's an interesting statistic, and stats can be twisted and turned to say whatever, almost whatever you want. So you take this for what it's worth. But roughly, about 70% of Americans currently say they would count themselves as some sort of a Christian. Now, again, I don't look at that and say, well, that's great. We're like one step away from returning to being a Christian nation. I don't think that's what that indicates. I think probably there are a lot of people who identify Jesus or God as someone important, but they are not necessarily living a Christian life. So what if we took that 70% of the nation and we kind of cut it in half? What if half of that 70% said, I am living, I am pursuing God, I am living a Christian life. I am connected to a church. Now that number probably isn't that high, but let's just assume for a minute that half of that number is right. If you and I, as followers of Christ, decide that our behavior within this nation is significant, we as individual Christians and as the collective body of Christ can move the needle and return some thought about who actually has blessed us with the opportunity to be here. See, that's the great thing about this country. You and I as individuals can change our community, and when communities change, it begins to change larger communities, and that begins to change states, and ultimately it can change our nation. But you and I have a responsibility to decide how we act, irregardless of who is in Washington or Lansing, how we behave and how we live. Go to the book of Galatians. This is where we're going to spend the rest of our time. That was like the longest sermon intro ever. Yes, we're going to use the Bible. So Galatians in chapter 5 is where we're going to spend the remainder of our time here. Because Paul writes in response to freedom. There was a bit of a kind of a tug of war, a push-pull that was happening among those Jesus followers and the kind of the old guard of the Jewish church. The Jewish church said that the law is the thing that determines the depth and relationship with God that we have. And Paul is starting to say, wait a minute, it's not the law that makes you good followers of God. You are now freed because of what Jesus does. You are free to live differently. There is, in fact, a higher plane that you are being called to. He makes a statement about how we're to respond to our personal freedoms. Look at chapter 5 in Galatians, verse 13. You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge in the flesh. What he's pointing out something here. When no one is watching and we have the freedom to do what we want, we have the tendency to find the lowest rung on the ladder and say, well, that's all that's expected of me. We have a tendency to be very selfish about it and think only of us. And Paul is saying, do not use your freedom solely for you. Don't neglect what God has called you to do. Don't ask, how low can I go? Where is the line? What can I get away with? How little can I do? Paul is saying you are called to something much better than that. In fact, at the end of 13, he says this, rather, instead of serving yourself, serve one another humbly in love. There is no law that requires you and I to serve one another. There's no law. There's no expectation. There's no written law that says, oh, by the way, you need to give this many hours each week to serve someone other than yourself. There is no law about that. The law simply says you are allowed to be as selfish as you want to be. But Jesus invites us to a different place. In fact, Paul echoes what Jesus says. Look at verse 14. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. This is the same thing that Jesus says in the book of Matthew and Mark. Jesus echoes this statement that says, the greatest thing that you and I need to do is be willing to love one another. So as we move through this post-election season, as we consider our freedoms, as we consider and think about what it would be like if we did this, what would happen in your life, in mine, if we leveraged our freedom for others, that I let other people go ahead of me, that I am willing to treat my spouse the way that I want them to treat me, that I'm going to treat my husband or wife in the way that I hope as my kids get older and they get married, I hope that they would marry someone who would treat them like this. That I'm going to respect my boss, even if my boss doesn't respect or like me. What would it be like? How would things change if we began to do and live like this? If you jump down into verse 22, Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit. And he says, look, there's all kinds of things that can derail us, but these are the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And then he adds this little statement at the very end. Against such things, there is no law. You and I are free to live in almost any fashion that we want in this country. God is calling us through Paul and certainly through the life of Jesus that we are to live on this freedom plane, that there is this idea that we can experience greater freedom by allowing us to go to the back, by allowing our freedom to be experienced and showing up in the lives of other people. That we would no longer ask, what can I get away with? Where's the line before I get in trouble? See, the world is instantly better when we behave like this, because this is how God designed the world to work. Now, there might be a sense in your heart, in your spirit right now. Well, that is a pipe dream, Pastor. Nice try, but that is never going to happen. And I can remember feeling like that I would be very cynical hearing something like this a bunch of years ago. And maybe it won't ever happen. But I want to pose this to you. This is the base level of what it means to be a Christian. This is the basics of Christian life. And if we don't get this right, we skipped a couple verses in here. Go to verse 15, because Paul tells us what happens if we don't get this thing right. He says, if you bite and devour each other, watch out or you will be destroyed by each other. That is a verse that I have seen for a lot of different years and not really paid attention to what exactly he was meaning when he creates that little picture in the middle of this instruction about freedom. But what he's talking about is that liberty and freedom devours freedom when it is all about the individual. Freedom, my freedom, when I think about my freedom and just do what I want to do because I'm free to do it, it destroys the community. It gobbles up your freedom. And we end up destroying one another in the process. Let's be honest about something. I'm gonna say this with a little caveat. This might frustrate some of us this morning. Our greatest threat to this country, to its sovereignty, to its future, is not outside forces. It's not some vigilante group coming and laying waste to this land. It's not illegal immigration. The greatest threat to this country is us, Americans. When we allow our freedoms to take the top shelf, to become the most important thing, that I pursue my freedom above all other things, that is the greatest threat to us as a country. When we undermine our freedom and our liberty and we leverage it only for us. In fact, the founding fathers warned us about this very thing. That if we would let go of our divine accountability and our moral absolute sense, that this is the kind of thing that would happen. But here is the hope. The church, and only the church, not the building, but the people. We are the ones that hold the key to deciding to leverage our freedom for others. We are the ones, and I think God is very purposeful in this. He has given us the power to leverage our freedom for other people. That is how things change. Now, maybe you're sitting here and you're thinking, all right, I'm not so sure that that's true. But if it is true, if you're right, how do we do it? How do we experience this kind of change? Go ahead and put that next slide up there. Here are four statements I want to invite you to take home. And if you're a note taker, certainly write these down. Put them somewhere you can see them. These are four statements that can begin to change the way you see your freedoms and how it impacts other people. The first one is, do what's just, not what I can justify. Do what is just, not what I can justify. We have turned skirting the truth and jumping around the obvious and what is right into an Olympic sport, haven't we? We have turned it into, well, I don't have to do this. I can justify my actions by this and that, and I don't have to do that thing that's right in front of me, the thing that is obvious. Here's another little piece of that first one. When you go into a situation, whether it's your work or your family or some other, any situation, doesn't even have to be difficult situations. Ask a couple of questions of yourself. How high can I reach and how can I help? I mean, just think about this. If you ask that last question, how can I help at your workplace, you will freak out the people that you work with, won't you? Because at your workplace, it's more of, hey, we don't ask that kind of question around here. You help yourself and I help myself, and sometimes I might help myself to some of the stuff that you're helping yourself to. We help ourselves. We don't figure out how to help anybody else. Husbands, you want to make your wife wonder what's going on? Ask, how can I help? And she will wonder, what is going on? My husband doesn't ask those kind of questions. Kids, if you want control of your parents, ask, how can I help? And your parents will be like, man, something's going on with them, because they don't ask those kind of questions. See, those kind of questions are very counterintuitive to the way that we live and the way that we work in this world, because our world has determined that what is most important is you and whatever you want, that you get what you want. The second statement there, do what's moral, not what's, do what is responsible, not what's possible. Here's an important thing. I didn't use this language when I was doing student ministry, but I remember posing this with students in the time that I was a youth pastor. If you are not willing to take responsibility for the potential outcome of whatever it is that you're doing, don't do it. I mean, this is part of the problem that we have in our country. We don't ask questions. Well, what might happen if I go down this road? I mean, if everything goes perfect, there's this outcome. If everything goes just right. But if one thing goes wrong, we're down here and things kind of go messy. Things get screwed up. If you are not willing to deal with the potential and be responsible for the potential outcomes of whatever it is that you're choosing to do, don't do it. And it sounds very simplistic and very elementary. One of my friends has a rule in the classroom that he teaches: what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong. And make sure you understand how you're behaving. See, if you and I aren't willing to take responsibility for the decisions and the choices that we are making, don't make the choice. Because someone else ultimately will take responsibility for what you do. This third one, do what's moral, not what's modeled. Make a decision, a determination, that you're going to follow the moral ethic of Jesus' life. And if you hear that phrase and you go, well, I don't even know what the moral ethic of Jesus was, well, then it's time to start reading about Jesus. First four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, tell about the life of Jesus. And if you go in asking this question, what is the moral ethic of Jesus? And you begin to read through those four books of the Bible, God is going to show you what the moral ethic is of the life of Jesus. He's going to show you. There's no question about that. Because the ethic of Jesus is at this very high standard. But it is something that is achievable if you and I are willing to put in the work. And this last one, this comes out of, again, my experience as a student pastor. Honor God. In the middle of all that you are doing, decisions that you are making, does this honor God? That is the question to ask. When I was doing student ministry, I remember we would have our annual sex and relationships conversation. And some kids would be like, oh man, I don't want anything to do with that. So they wouldn't come for a couple weeks that we were doing that. And there were some kids that really engaged in it and really involved themselves in it. And I remember after one conversation one night, a couple kids came up and said, they asked the question. This is the question. This is the legal question. What is okay? Where is the line? I'm in this relationship with this guy or girl. And what is it that I can do in that relationship? And it's this, I'm attracted to this person of the opposite sex, and I want to know what I can do. What they're asking is, what can I get away with before I'm in real trouble? And I said, you know what? You're asking the wrong question. The right question is this. This decision, does this honor God? And that's not just a question for relationship issues. That is for every single thing that you and I do. Everything that we are a part of, every decision that we make, everything that we chase after, does this honor God? And when we start asking that question, We'll just use some of the language of the framers of the Constitution. It becomes self-evident. It becomes obvious. This is what we do. As a follower of Jesus, this is what makes the most sense. You might remember the summer of 2015 in Charleston, South Carolina, when a young man went into a Bible study and gained the trust of the people that were there. They welcomed him in. They had the Bible study. And then after it was done, he pulled out a gun and he started shooting and killed a lot of people in that church. Devastating circumstance. And I don't know if you remember seeing the courtroom play out the way it did. I was going to play this for you, but the audio isn't any good, so I'm just going to tell you what was said. At the end of the trial, right before sentencing, the judge does what the judge always does. He gives the family of the victims the opportunity to speak to the accused, and now the guilty, because the guilty verdict had already been received. And what was said in that courtroom was amazing. The family members, one by one, stood up and said some version of, "I forgive you. You took away something that was not yours to take. You took away my family, my aunt, my grandmother, my father. You took away something that was not yours to take, but I forgive you." And it was unbelievable. If you've never watched that, I would encourage you to, it's not hard to find. Because it is a stunning thing that took place. And they did what the law did not require them to do at all. So they had some freedom to choose. How am I going to respond to this? The most devastating thing that will probably happen in any of their lives. And they have the freedom to stand up and say whatever they want. The judge has given them the opportunity to speak. And what they said, well, they didn't cuss him out. I mean, they could have. And if that had happened, I might have gone, well, I don't agree with doing that, but I understand, right? We would have sat there and said, I understand that response. But their response wasn't that. Their response was forgiveness. And there was one individual, a relative of Myra Thompson, this young man stood up and said this. He said, "I forgive you and my family forgives you. But we would like to take this opportunity to ask him to repent, to confess, to give your life to the one that matters most, Jesus Christ." Now, there would have been, if someone could have rushed up there and kind of interrupted this relative of Myra Thompson, they might have said, "Hey, wait a minute. You realize what you're saying? I mean, you're a believer in this Jesus, and you believe in an afterlife and a heaven that all people who believe in Jesus go to, and you're inviting this guy to come to heaven with you. Do you really want that kind of guy in heaven?" Right? But his response was very simple. It's not the response of someone with rights, but the response of someone who has recognized that God, through Jesus Christ, has saved them, and that is something that is for everyone. See, there are choices in the midst of our rights. It's stunning when we see this kind of response, isn't it? It's kind of shocking because we don't often see that kind of response. It is important through all of this. As I was kind of closing up my thoughts for this, I thought it would be very easy for us to interpret this as, well, I'm just asking you to be a better person. But that's not what this is. This is not a soft towing of the gospel. See, because that's not what Jesus was asking or what he was after. What he was after was us understanding that this is a basic understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. And our country is a mess for a lot of reasons, right? It didn't start with the last election, correct? Can we agree with that? It's been kind of a wreck for a while. This has been a train that's been going for decades. But you and I, as followers of Jesus, have a hope that we can change the world, a hope that is rooted in Christ and lived out daily. This is the challenge of following Jesus, that you and I would understand that our choices and our freedom are to be leveraged into the lives of others, not just spent on ourselves. Let's pray. Father, we are so very grateful for the opportunity that you give us, the freedom that you provide, the way that you show us that we have this wonderful opportunity to live in. There is freedom that we get to experience. God, we are thankful for the way that you continue to correct us and draw us closer, to bring us into this realization that our lives are not supposed to just be lived for us. That there is a greater thing that you have invited us into. So, Father, this morning we ask that you would be incredibly loud in our ears this morning. Thank you for the way that you continue to call us. Some of us need to be willing to sacrifice our freedoms. Some of us need to be willing to accept that you are calling us to let go of things that we have held on to for too long. And God, we acknowledge that this is hard work. This is difficult. But you're calling us to this place anyways. So, Father, thank you for all that you have done, all that you have created, and this place that you have invited us into. May we hear you. May we respond with open hearts.